You rely on this podcast to stay informed and connected with your local community, and we rely on you. Without listener support, this show simply wouldn't exist. Be a part of the team that makes this show possible by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute. Donate at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thank you.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. Hi, I'm Bill Radke. What about you? Can we count on you? Can we put you down for having the new airport in your backyard? Because that would really help us out of a jam. Or would it? Do we really need a new airport? We're going to get into that later on the Week in Review today. We've got our journalist panel, and today I'm talking Seattle Times investigations editor Jonathan Martin. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Bill.
Axios Seattle reporter Melissa Santos. Hi, Melissa.
Hey there.
KUOW online producer and editor. Hi, Dyer Oxley.
Good afternoon.
Welcome back, everybody. And you can stream this show and see these faces on YouTube or Facebook. You just search KUOW Public Radio. Let's get to it. Number one topic, how radical are Washington State Democrats? This week, in a special legislative session with a Democratic governor and Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate, the state increased the penalties for having and using drugs. Not that Democrats were happy about what they had just done.
It has been the most challenging piece of policy that I've worked on in my career as a legislator.
It's a hard-fought compromise for a really, really hard issue.
That's Democratic Senator June Robinson of Everett and Democratic Representative April Berg of Mill Creek. Melissa, why is this party bemoaning a drug law that it drove?
Well, really, the Supreme Court drove this. I think we have to go back 2 years ago when the state Supreme Court struck down our state's felony drug law. And that precipitated this conversation where there was an agreement on how to replace it. And there hasn't been agreement on how to replace it. So there were some Democrats who would like to see drug possession and drug use in public even totally decriminalized so that you would not have any criminal penalties. That's not what they did. They went ahead and made it a gross misdemeanor. That's a step up from where it's been at the misdemeanor level for the past 2 years under this temporary law that was passed 2 years ago after the court ruling. But it's less than the felony. So that's the compromise that was reached. But, you know, you just have too many factions in this issue within the Democratic Party, everywhere along the spectrum as well. Republicans had differing views about how should we do this. Not all Republicans wanted to make it a felony again, for instance, either. But some did. So it's just this huge range of issues. And what we saw is that they had this spectacular breakdown during the legislative session on the last day where the House, controlled by Democrats, would not approve the compromise that was reached at that time with other Democrats. So they had to do something, and the governor was kind of like, get it together, everyone. And then they did. And here we are.
Yeah, the real question here was whether or not the philosophical question was whether or not you're going to treat drug use as a criminal problem versus using the criminal sanctions in order to incentivize treatment. So there's both sides here on the philosophical debate, I think, had reasonable grounds to stand on. It was interesting, going to Melissa's point, the final vote, the no's ended up being pretty small, but the no's included two very conservative Eastern Washington Republicans and two very liberal Seattle Democrats. You know, I think that there is the real question here is going to be implementation. The compromise that was reached after, as Moses said, the breakdown at the end of the last session had a lot. There's a lot in this bill. There's a lot of funding for treatment. I'm not sure if there's enough funding for the workforce that is going to be required to stand up more clinics. There was also one of the kind of the messy compromises. It was interesting was that it allowed cities and counties, gave cities and counties the right to give notice if a new drug needle exchange clinic was going in. So there's like a local preemption kind of thing where I think this was a concession to the more conservative approach here. But also could undermine
a right to give notice, meaning a kind of if you don't like it, you would call that a warning, fair warning. Yeah. In order to block it.
Yeah.
Right?
Say there's going to be a new needle exchange clinic here in the U District. You tell give our neighbors all the right to come in and protest, essentially. So there was a lot of compromise that was built into this bill. In the end, I found it interesting. This is kind of a triumph of the moderates in an era where we have increasingly radicalization on the left and the right. Give them credit for getting this done.
That's exactly kind of the observation I made too. You say moderates. I've been calling this compromise and so forth the Goldilocks zone, right? They didn't get too hot, too cold. It was, I guess time will tell if it's just right. But it's interesting that in one day they were able to come up with a compromise after, you know, an entire session for this to kind of get bumbled right at the
arguably end. After two years.
There was a ton of process here. There's 2 years of massive process.
Made me think we should have more one-day deadlines almost to try to maybe get people to compromise.
They respond to deadlines for sure.
Yeah. The thing that is kind of jarring me on this, though, and you touched upon this a little bit, is that there is an implementation factor. We have a lot of funding, I think $63 million for everything from public defenders to health management hubs. But if we have a problem right now, right, of saying, hey, someone's you can't sleep here, you got to go to a shelter, where's that shelter, right? If you need to go into treatment right now, where is that treatment center? Because we really do not have that infrastructure set up right now for the need that we have now. So when this law goes into place in July, I'm kind of hesitant to tell people, hey, expect everything to like go into place, because great, you can fund a public defender, you've got funding for places for people to go, but we don't necessarily have that standing up right now.
So it might be misleading to say we really balance the punishment part of it with this. We're going to stand up all these services and help, but is it going to be in time for people to be diverted into that?
Seattle was not charging possession. Mm-hmm. King County was not charging possession. I mean, people who had possession, who could potentially get charged with possession, sometimes you're being charged with like burglary or robbery or, you know, with a property crime associated with, supporting their addiction. But this was almost a moot debate for the city of Seattle. It was the resources that come with it, and mm-hmm. going to Dyer's point about the implementation here, it'll be interesting to see how the rest of the state, you know, there's lots of purple parts of the state, and how prosecutors are going to use this authority.
What's going to happen in Seattle and King County? We have Ann Davison now, who talks a harder line on this. Are Seattle and King County going to be how much is that up to prosecutors? What about just police and sheriffs and county executives? What's going to happen?
I know from covering the marijuana beat for a while that Dan Satterberg said he just never took marijuana cases because juries won't convict. So it's not just a matter of a will of a prosecutor. It's like they know what a jury will do, and a Seattle jury is not going to convict anybody for possession.
You also got to consider, I would expect Seattle, King County to be able to stand itself up on this a lot quicker than, say, a Soton County, which is the furthest I can think of us from right now. You know, you go to some like rural area, are they going to be able to go, okay, we're going to have a treatment facility ready to go? It's more likely they're going to probably contract with somebody away from them and send folks to that, if they can even do that.
Covered it?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're talking mostly about enforcement and penalties. 180 days in jail for the first and second offense.
Yes.
Yeah, $1,000 fine maximum, but then the jail time goes up with more offenses. And as I say, focusing mostly on punishment, but there are millions of dollars that are now available statewide in funding for expanding treatment facilities, other resources. Lets local governments allow things like needle, you know, make their own rules when it comes to needle exchanges and things. So there's some balance here between legal accountability and treatment, but we're questioning how that's going to work in effect if this stuff isn't ready to go, especially in a rural area. Is that it?
Yeah, and I do think that there may be some attempt to enforce it in Seattle now more with Ann Davison, a city attorney. She already filed some legislation to try and match the state law to the city law, or match the city statute to the state law, which would allow the city attorney's office to charge gross misdemeanors for possession. I don't know if the city council will go ahead and say, yeah, let's keep doing that. There might be some conflict there.
One forward-looking thing, too, there had been some debate about decriminalization. Oregon went that way, and there was discussion about a ballot initiative. I kind of wonder now, I think the Oregon decriminalization effort has had, there's been a lot of reporting about the real difficulties of standing up the alternative to a criminal process in Portland, and kind of made Portland the poster child of, like, a Democratic city gone wrong. Mm-hmm. And I wonder now if this, what this debate is going to do to either feed that one part of the ideological debate, which was, has a point about not criminalizing drug use. But now we've seen this debate play out. The legislature went the other way. And then there's the Oregon situation that could be a potential, headwind for that kind of ballot initiative. I'm curious what happens.
The Northwest Drug Possession Lab, basically, is what we are. We'll see how this all plays out. Right.
Okay, topic number two on KOW's Week in Review. 2 years ago, to get a grip on homelessness, Seattle gave over some authority to a new countywide agency, the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. And this week, the CEO of that agency quit. Mark Doans announced they're burned out and will resign next month. The deputy CEO is taking over for now, Jonathan. So is this important?
It is important because what the Regional Homelessness Authority, I'm going to call this RHA for shortness, is what they're doing is important. Not to get too much building, too much context, but prior to the RHA, homelessness response was essentially a City Hall issue. We used to cover homelessness from our City Hall reporter. It was run by cities, counties. It was not a regional issue. It was not a statewide issue. And the concept being that shelters, the city of Seattle, which had more money and a political philosophy which would supporting responding to homelessness, would go big on this and creating this meme around magnet city, Seattle being a magnet city for homelessness. We know that homelessness is driven by a number of factors, housing costs, certainly substance abuse issues, legacy of criminal justice reforms, and a number of other issues. And those are not city issues. Those are regional, they're statewide, those are federal issues. So the RHA was a response by the philanthropic community, which had gotten big on this, and sort of moderate leaders in the city and county and the business community saying we need to have a regional approach to homelessness the same way we have a regional approach to something like sound transit, transportation. So Doans was a very charismatic they were a high level policy thinker, and I think that the issue that led to them resigning were in large part administrative. My colleague Greg Kim did a very interesting story about a month ago about how for the second year in a row the RHA was not cutting contracts on time, leaving large, well-established nonprofits to basically run on their credit cards, max out their credit cards. So that's the kind of the big picture. There's a lot else to say, but I feel like I'm talking too much.
I think that there was pushback, and I think the Seattle Times has reported on this. Everyone's reported on this. There was pushback to this idea that a plan that the Homelessness Authority put out under Doans that it would take $10 to $12 billion to solve homelessness in the next 5 years. Even some of the city council members were saying that just kind of like stopped everyone in the water from discussion about like some of the more actionable things to do now.
There was an audible gasp.
Yeah, it was big. And so I don't know how much of a role that is. They now, as of this week, have put out sort of a scaled back version of that proposal, right, as he's saying he's going to step down. So it seems like there's a change of direction there, and that might have been a factor. They also got dinged by the feds for not awarding housing slots. Correct me if I have this wrong, Jonathan, based on federal rules exactly. I think they got dinged maybe at least once, maybe twice on that. So there was that. That's the administrative stuff they're talking about a bit here.
I think you're just going to have to pay for it, Seattle. Sorry, I know this is the gut reaction response to all this, but the burnout factor in Doan's resignation letter is the thing that kind of stood out to me, and I might be reading into this too much, but Seattle has a homelessness debt, if you will, and it's compounding over and over, and it seems like our region is only making the minimum payment on it, right? If you really want to get it down, we've got to just invest those billions that were said there, or else it's just going to keep compounding.
Can I ask about that? Paying it down versus, wasn't this initiative called something like Ending Homelessness or Everybody Housed. Or we have so many of these programs called Zero Whatever, Zero Homelessness, Zero Pedestrian Death, Zero Traffic Death, Zero Incarceration. So was Doan's just give it, you want to know what it would take to have zero homelessness? $10 to $12 billion. Weren't they just answering the question?
Yeah, we need to stop saying things like ending homelessness, zero. And I really like that they put a dollar sign onto this thing because that's actionable, whereas we're just going to end it. We have a zero thing, a really great little taglines, but it's just setting yourself up for when that clock hits and you haven't ended homelessness, all the criticism is going to come, and now we're distracted by that. Yeah, we should really stop saying that.
That number that they're talking about was a real aspirational. It was sort of like, if you're really going to get there, this is what it's going to take. Mm-hmm. The actual functional plans, there has a 5-year plan. It's not that. It's not been changed all that much. The RHA and Doan's had not been big on tiny house villages, which had been a strategy the city had done. There was a lot of effort to do these hotel shelters, a real effort to get away from these what are called congregate shelters, which are basically cots in a gymnasium. Because people who are homeless, as if I were homeless, I would not want to go sleep in a cot in a gym. And there was also an effort to really have what called net functional zero homelessness in downtown Seattle. And functional zero means it's a system that's so responsive that if a person becomes homeless, then they're immediately taken care of. So their ideas were good. I mean, it was interesting, but that the downtown initiative has really kind of been stopped. Seattle Times Project Homeless Team again has been written about that quite a bit, and it's just not worked. So I think that there's a concern. I have a concern as formerly the Project Homeless editor. I really kind of learned a lot about this issue. That this is there's a burnout factor here. We had the 10-year plan in homelessness under the Bush administration. That led to no. And then we've got the next one. We got the state of emergencies declared. And that's not. And it's like this. We see the more. I think the concern is throwing more money and more money and more money and all these aspirational hopes. And it's the same problem all Groundhog Day all over again. And that's why the RHA, I said at the beginning, what they're doing is important because this is a different approach to how the regional entities are approaching a very structural, very broad, very complicated problem.
It is possibly an impossible job to be honestly. Yeah. Like, I think that there's probably
that was my
some
first
truth
reaction
that.
When the whole agency even began.
Yeah. And sorry, some of the no, it's fine. And some of the people have said also, this is still a baby agency, right? I mean, it's still, you're going to have a lot of growing pains at any agency. I've not been studying it as closely as Jonathan, for instance, but it is going to be a very hard job for anyone to come in and have and hit every note that people want them to in this job with a new agency.
One thing Dyer talked about too, about Seattle just got to pay up. I mean, the irony is that Seattle and King County pretty much are paying for this. I think there's 29 or 39 cities in King County, something like that. And five cities have signed on, plus Seattle. And the five cities, the North King County cities, signed on with a dollar amount that was very, very low. So all of the East Side, there's money in the East Side. They have homeless people. All the cities in South King County, a lot of homeless people down there. And they are not bought into the RHA. So far, it is basically a Seattle and King County plus these five northern cities just came on, supported by the business community and philanthropy. So
the Times recently had a story that covered pretty quickly the federal new White House funding that's going to come through. Do we feel that that's going to have any influence on this? No.
No,
it's not really funding. Is
it's
it?
no funding came with it. It's like just
gonna
kind
have
of
like a person.
We're going to coordinate.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a nice pat on the back.
It's like, yeah. I that's why I kept thinking. I was like, shouldn't you have already been doing that? You weren't coordinating. I thought you were because there's been like money from the feds. It's just so. But yeah, I know the funding has been a huge source of concern for the mayor. He's not commenting a lot about Doan's departure except in positive ways now. But Mayor Harrell in the past has privately and somewhat publicly expressed concern with how much money is coming from Seattle to pay for this and whether we're getting the bang for our buck.
Yeah, the Stranger quoted sources saying that Mayor Harrell would be ecstatic if Doan's were to step down and surprised it didn't happen sooner. But who knows? But so these other cities outside Seattle, they're not paying much for the solution, but to their credit, they are complaining about Seattle a lot. So it's not like they're doing nothing. Okay, so let's take a short break, and then more of Week in Review. We've got Jonathan Martin here. We've got Dyer Oxler. We've got Melissa Santos. We've got a great show to continue if you'll stick around.
This podcast is free, and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks!
KUOW's Week in Review, continuing. Bill Radke here, hosting a great journalist panel with Melissa Santos from Axios, Jonathan Martin from the Seattle Times, and Dyer Oxley from KUOW. Topic number three, where should we put our new airport? How about nowhere? Does nowhere work for you? This week, our governor signed a law that dismantles the state commission that was studying airport locations in Pierce, Thurston, one near Enumclaw in King County. So does this just mean we are going to expand the airports we have? Is that the plan?
I think that's the most likely outcome from this. It's possible they'll convene and try and find a new site, but just no one is going to want the airport. No one. There's no one in the entire state who's going to want it because there's jet noise, obviously. And then also the infrastructure you have to build to the airport, roads, et cetera. If you're building it in a great green field that some counties have been working to keep as a great green field for decades, they don't want suddenly all this infrastructure going out there when they've been like, it's going to flood us. So it's like this weird reversal of like yimby nimby like stuff where it's like some people even told me a while ago in Pierce County, this is not in my backyard stuff. It's we don't want it, but it's not that. It's because we want to preserve the open space we've been trying to preserve. It's actually like pro-environment what we're trying to do and have the density where it's supposed to be and not spread it everywhere. So it's kind of a weird debate. But I do think there will be more focus on how much can you expand Painfield and Everett. Maybe Bremerton. There's these little airports that they're going to look a lot more closely at. And then, you know, the idea of high-speed rail, too. There's environmental folks that want to say, why do we need to just encourage more airport travel, especially for short trips, when there's maybe more environmentally friendly options? So that might get a little bit more of a look. I don't know.
20 years, 1 million homes, I believe, is the estimate for Washington that we are going to need. So I might be the odd one out in this room. I think we do need a new airport, but it's like a new airport and then some. My main reaction to this entire discussion is a little bit broader in that we need to stop with this philosophy that we have to cram everything into Western Washington. And that's where they wanted to stick this airport. Pierce County, King County, Thurston County. Seattle is no longer the funnel or the bottleneck that it once was. It's now Western Washington. It expands from Everett all the way down to Olympia. We have people commuting into Seattle from Olympia, Enumclaw. You know, that's the reality of what we're facing. And to just try to cram more and more and more with all these people coming in, I'm in favor of going over the mountains and throwing an airport there. I'm not trying to be not in my backyard, go to Yakima, but
Thus high-speed rail, as Melissa was saying, that's
right.
The connection?
Exactly. We need to spread out. We need to stop thinking that you want everything closer to the main hub in Seattle. We need to find other places where we can create future hubs because it's not all going to fit.
It's like that Denver and the Denver airport where you feel like you're landing in Kansas. We had a discussion with the Port of Seattle folks this week in our newsroom, and they were talking about how much they already are doing to expand the airport. They really understand that the capacity is maxed out, and going to Dyer's point, the projections of like it's like 94 million passengers by 2050, which is like
another 27 million, I think, that beyond what we have now. Yeah,
I mean, you also have to consider it's not just folks like us hop in a plane. This is freight.
Yeah,
this is stuff coming in that's coming to your store. It's stuff that's going out that we're shipping.
Well, there is a terminal expansion underway at SeaTac, though. Mm-hmm. I think they've calculated that into their projections that we still need more, though. I mean, it's not.
And Painfield had added Alaska's Got Flights. Although going to the same problems of citing an airport, like the Mukilteo around Painfield has been kind of raising some cane about the noise and all that. The airports are big, noisy, messy places. And it was interesting, too, there was a lawsuit recently by the residents around SeaTac. We're talking about, I think it was an extra, how many was, 100 excess deaths per year due to environmental problems from the airport. So not only, it's like, okay, you got to deal with the noise and the pollution. Oh, and it's going to kill you, too. Good luck with the, it's kind of the mother of all siting decisions.
Well, if you look at our region alone, it's not just SeaTac. We have JBLM, which is a major military airport. We've mentioned Painfield, mentioned Bremerton. We also got Renton. Mm-hmm. We also got one down in Olympia. I mean, those are a cluster of smaller and larger airports, but this the air is filled here.
I'm just going to just throw this out there. So we kind of know that a carbon tax is coming at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And there is hardly anything you can do that is more polluting than running an airline. And I kind of wonder if we have some era of, you know, cheap travel, and if we actually price in the carbon cost of flights, if it's going to be flying is going to be a little less, affordable, a little less realistic.
It's interesting you bring that up. The Tom Bonsi, the legendary Tom Bonsi, sorry, Bill, who recently retired from KUW, had a story. One of his last stories was about the emergence of electric airplanes, mostly for passenger service, utilizing the region's smaller airports. I mean, this is spanning everything from California to Washington to, one, develop a new market of air travel, but also to free up pressure on the area's airports that we already have. The anticipation for that is electric aircraft or hydrogen fuel cells, things like that, that are going to carry folks in different directions than just depending on SeaTac, for example, to fly out to different larger airports. A carbon tax might actually feed right into the aims of that emerging industry in our region.
So you're saying maybe if air travel, if we're living in this bubble of affordable air travel, then maybe we're not going to need so much air until there's electric planes that can fly everybody everywhere. But if we're depending on fuel, maybe they're going to be fewer flights because people won't be able to afford to fly with this.
What it reminds me of is back in the day, I'm going to be the old timer, but we had something called Washington Public Power Supply System.
Oh, yeah.
And their projections were based on, we are going to need so much more electricity, we're going to need to build massive nuclear power plants around the state. And it ended up, luckily, it didn't implode, but financially it imploded. You'll still see, if you're driving out to Aberdeen from Olympia, you'll see one of the stacks that was actually built and is now, it never became a plant. It kind of reminds me of we project these things and we think that we're going to need this because all the trend lines tell us we are going to need X amount more, you know, gigawatts of electricity. Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe we won't need quite that much flight capacity, maybe. I don't know.
Can we just make ourselves a little less desirable? How can we make people want to come here less? Smoky summers could help.
Well, we have those. Those are probably happening.
Yeah. Okay. Do we cover that? Airport? So based to recap, it's not going to happen. There was a commission, a state commission, studying rural locations, greenfields, they call them, right? Just dropping an airport where it's not in a built-up area, in Pierce and Thurston, and also one near Enumclaw in King County. And those discussions are just off. So for now, we're looking at expansion or air travel getting so expensive that nobody flies.
Yeah, price everybody out.
Price everybody out. Okay, next topic. Which way we've been talking about decisions, okay, so far today. So where do you, dear listener, come in? Your vote. And we've got in Seattle and King County, this is the final week for candidates to file to run for office to try to get your vote. So, Jonathan, who are some of the candidates we should pay attention to and why?
Well, I'm going to kind of punt on that question because today is filing day.
We're going to wrap up early.
That was my plan, too. Yeah.
What it is there's an extraordinary number of candidates, in part because we have so many open seats.
Can we, Bernard, can we just play some music and have Jonathan list 48 candidates? I don't know. That's a bad idea. So what should we know about candidate filing week?
We have six wide open races, which is extraordinary. And that number of wide open races, because we had a bunch of incumbents just back out to say, I'm not doing this anymore. Which leads me to my next question is, who wants to become a Seattle City Council member? It's like, it feels like to me, it's a really tough job. You've got people yelling at you all the time. You've got intractable problems, like we've already just covered, you know, drug use, you know, a downtown that has got some problems. You've got homelessness. And now they've got a budget deficit that they're dealing with because, you know, all that real estate building, the city's budget is built on building, and they're not getting that money in anymore. So, you know, the two that are running are the two incumbents that are running, Dan Strauss and Andrew Lewis, both also are going to have very vigorous challenges. Andrew Lewis's district in the Ballard area got redistricted to make it look like slightly more conservative. Air quotes, Seattle conservative. But he's already got, you know, already got a lot of pressure. Dan Strauss does too in the Belltown area.
Tammy Morales' job? Because she's running too, and that's a different district with fewer challengers. And I haven't quite got a good read on that race in sort of Beacon Hill, like more South Seattle International District. So far, unless we get huge surprises this afternoon, she only has a couple of challengers, maybe two or three, compared to some of the open seats have just like 15 people who filed, right? Or seem like they're going to file. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how that will shake out. I think we will know more after the primary. And I know that's an easy answer, a convenient answer. But you don't know if all these people lining up, what the voters are going to say, right? Yeah. You don't know if they're going to pick the business-friendly candidate in some of these cases.
Right.
Or like pick two people who are like just very, very far left. Like, is it going to be a socialist versus a far left Democrat? We don't know.
Yeah. So there's nothing about who's filed. This is the end of filing. This is the deadline. We don't know enough yet to say, wow, look who's filed. Apparently, there's going to be a real change, or it's a very status quo. It's too early to say, Dyer.
Well, I don't have an answer to necessarily that, or the question of why someone would want to run. I do have an assumption to offer,
though. Thank I love goodness.
Forgive
Good.
Me to for being
I
like
think we call
the
that a hunch.
Instinct voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I did look over the list of folks who are signed up so far as of this recording. I think we're 4 hours shy of the deadline-ish or so. And I am picking out what I assume might be a Seattle trend, and I have a feeling that we have gone so far in a direction with Seattle candidates that I feel a lot more business-oriented candidates are emerging. We've always had that in the past, but in a very Seattle way. I noticed there's two cannabis industry
right.
You know, business owners. We have a bar owner, someone from the Fremont Chamber of Commerce, owner of Piroshki Piroshki.
Oh, yeah.
So I feel like we have a lot of different angles coming in from kind of the business areas of Seattle, probably wanting more of a voice. You do feel like that's a common complaint you've heard over the last decade or so. Voices coming to City Hall saying that you're not listening to the business voices, where the small businesses and so forth. You feel like you've heard a lot of the other end of that spectrum. And I do have to wonder, is there more of a push to get that voice back onto the council? It's not like it's been entirely absent.
It worked for Sarah Nelson.
Yeah, Sarah Nelson came in. I think a lot of folks would argue that when Bruce Harrell came in, they felt that he was the more business-friendly candidate. As we said before, it's Seattle, so it's kind of like what shade of blue are we going with here?
Yeah.
But I would estimate that the primary is going to tell us whether or not we're going to get more of these types of candidates emerging than what we've seen in the last maybe couple cycles.
Okay, well, then why don't we pause?
I like that hunch.
That's a hunch.
That's a good.
Okay, let's pause on a hunch and save a little bit of time for our next topics, because we'll find out a lot more as we see how these candidates actually do. Let's take a short break. Let's either ban some books or liberate some books and talk about artificial intelligence down the pike when we return on Week in Review. This is KUOW. I don't blame you for being tuned into Week in Review. I mean, you got me, Bill Radke, but mostly you got KUOW's Dyer Oxley, you got Axios, Melissa Santos, and Seattle Times investigations editor Jonathan Martin. Let's talk book banning, okay? It's on the rise, parents and politicians pushing to censor what students can see in public schools and public libraries. According to the American Library Association's Office of Intellectual Freedom, 2,571 unique titles were banned or challenged last year. That's up nearly 40% over the year before. 40% of those titles had protagonists or prominent secondary characters of color. 21% had titles with issues of race or racism. Another 41% have content related to LGBTQIA plus identity and themes, Jonathan. Seattle is trying to counteract this with a project called Books Unbanned. What's that?
The issue itself is really, I kind of focus on the issue itself, okay, which is a bigger picture national trend. And what struck me is how much this is an old is new again. Do you remember that in the 2001 Patriot Act, it gave the FBI authority to go snoop in your library usage? Mm. We've had the same books that have been debated about, The Handmaid's Tale, Lady Chatterley's Lover. Like, these books that just have been, like, we had this issue has come back around and around and around. What feels new around...
Are you there, God? It's me, Lady Chatterley.
Even remember The Night Kitchen by Marie Sendak?
Sure.
I saw that on a list.
I think Mickey is nude.
Yes,
that.
Right.
Yeah.
A nude boy.
Yeah.
The Harry Potter series. What I think is new about this time is that the combination of having a generation of trans youth coming out and pushing for recognition, and also the Black Lives Matter protests of the pandemic, both those having the pandemic, I think really activated the social base in a way that's like new and very vigorous. What you're seeing is also you see the polarization of our politics. Legislatures are increasingly single party and very pure in their approaches. You have the state of Texas, one of the most largest and most growing states in the country, has a bunch of bills right now that seem to have some juice that would be criminal sanctions against librarians for not policing lists of banned books. The extent of this round is just extraordinary to me. And, I'm not impartial on this issue. I'm a proud father of two trans kids, and watching the vigor at which particularly the trans community is targeted in these debates is just extremely painful.
I think there's a larger issue at play as well as beyond that, because, like you said, this is an age-old issue. Every year we have a new list of books that have been challenged and trying to be banned across the United States. I feel like it comes just from all corners of our political spectrum. Every year the Bible gets challenged quite often, for example.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. The issue here is there's that concerns me, and maybe this is just because I come from the world of journalism, is that there is a trend of challenging critical thinking with all of this. Whether you agree, disagree, like, dislike, whatever the contents of these books are, what you are short-circuiting is critical thinking, and that is a larger danger, I think, for our society. Book bans, prohibitions don't work. We know this. It didn't work with alcohol. It clearly has not worked with drugs. It doesn't work with information. As Seattle is proving, look, you can try to ban it in this state, but the internet exists, VPNs exist. You can always go online to Seattle to get to these books. Someone is going to find
them. That's
the
Books Unbanned project, allowing people access through digitally through Seattle's library.
Exactly.
Or is it the whole state? I'm not sure. Maybe just Seattle.
Well, and unless they've banned it somewhere else, because I believe this one has been challenged quite a bit too. Fahrenheit 51 is all about this as well. So the issue here of trying to ban information or ban the critical thought around these issues is something that I would worry about more in our society. Is I would rather hear somebody say, I disagree with this because I read the book, mm-hmm, and I know why, and then we can have a conversation. But look, an axe not put up to friction is dull, and your brain is the same way, right? If we just take away the friction from our lives, we're just going to get really dull as people.
That was very profound.
It was.
That was a very profound metaphor. I do not have anything that profound of a metaphor to say.
You're from Axios. Do you not have an axe-related metaphor yourself?
I do not have one, but I will say that it just really does fit into this theme. So again, the books banned is Seattle Public Library saying, hey, anyone 13 to 26 years old from anywhere in the U.S. can sign up for a library card and – for free and check out books from our library that are available digitally. You know, it's banned in your library, come to us kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So that's something that Washington State, again, I've covered politics for a long time, been probably too deep in our legislature this year, honestly. But, you know, that's something that our state is doing a lot. It's like, some of these battles are not on our front lines in a way, because, again, like we discussed, we're controlled entirely by Democrats, governor's office, both chambers of our legislature. So they're saying, how can we help people from those states in a lot of ways? They did that with an abortion shield law, which, you know, not going to get too deep into it, but aims to protect people who come here for abortions from state laws that try and criminalize or restrict that. And all providers here who might provide that service to someone from another state, we did that. Gender-affirming care, those laws also try to protect doctors who are providing that to people who might come from states where it's banned, and those individuals as well. So this is kind of what we're doing, saying, how can we get in on this debate and do something about it, even though here maybe those things are not at the forefront of our political debate in the same way. That's not to say there aren't people who are trans or who are have difficulty accessing abortion in some ways in our state. There are. But it's not necessarily the legislature trying to make that problem worse or trying to make things even more inaccessible in our state. So they're trying to help others access it. So that's just kind of a theme I think about when I see the books unbanned. It's another way of trying to do that.
It's like a sanctuary library.
Yes. And I think that's what I think that. Yeah, that's exactly.
I love Dyer's point about the lack of intellectual curiosity. It's like you kind of rob us of. Rob us of the intellectually provocative writing, and you kind of rob us of our creative ambition. You know, it's a really worrisome trend. The only thing that gives me comfort is that we've had trends like this before. Movements flame in, flame, and then fade. And I hope that our librarians will be safe and our libraries will be full.
Can't stop the presses.
Right. Speaking of the unstoppable digital spread of information, let's get to our final topic here. Artificial intelligence is here, and the Seattle area is helping, is opening the door, is welcoming it in. Not only do we have a lot of AI startups here, but Microsoft is investing billions and billions in this Silicon Valley company, OpenAI, whose CEO testified this week to Congress and said, basically, thank you for having me. My industry is dangerous.
I do think some regulation would be quite wise on this topic.
What is so dangerous about AI?
If you want a good roundup of all this shameless self-plug, yesterday's Today So Far newsletter was all about this, rounding up our reporting and then some. Imagine a world where you go online and you are getting news from somebody and you are making actionable decisions on that news, but only to find out later that the person you're watching is not real. That was entirely computer generated. The voice you were listening to was not real. That's entirely computer generated. Both those technologies in AI exist right now and are being used. And so that is just one ethical quandary that we're dealing with right now. But beyond that, there are concerns across many industries, maybe some more or less founded, but is this going to replace jobs, or will this become a part of the workflow of many jobs? One angle you can look at this is, this going to be like the movie Her, where artificial intelligence is part of our daily lives as an assistant and a helper? Or is this going to be the Terminator, where essentially this AI is going to take over jobs and humanity altogether? Two very different perspectives. I guess Blade Runner's in the middle of all that. But there's most of the concern, I think, that is happening right now is because we just don't know. And I think that makes people a little fearful. To have a CEO, like we just heard, say we need to be regulated, I might play into a little bit of that concern.
Yeah, I'm going to just play a little bit more of Sam Altman.
OpenAI was founded on the belief that artificial intelligence has the potential to improve nearly every aspect of our lives, but also that it creates serious risks we have to work together to manage. We think that regulatory intervention by governments will be critical to mitigate the risks of increasingly powerful models. For example, the U.S. government might consider a combination of licensing and testing requirements for development and release of AI models above a threshold of capabilities. I think if this technology goes wrong, it can go quite wrong.
My life's work is a menace. Please stop me.
Well, there's the context, too, of the what we didn't do with social media. I think
this
is really the next thing in tech. And, you know, I think we could all look back and say, yeah, they absolutely should have regulated social media in a different way. So I think there might be some preventative kind of posturing going on.
And you saw that referenced explicitly in this congressional hearing before the Judiciary Committee. The IBM, an IBM executive, I forget their title, but she was saying this cannot be the era of move fast and break things. That's a direct quote. And that's referencing Mark Zuckerberg saying that about which at some point in the development of Facebook or early on. And so
he was
saying,
just showing us pictures of college friends.
Well, I mean, maybe it was the face smash or whatever era. I'm not sure when Zuckerberg said that anymore. But you know, I mean, specifically referencing, we don't want this to be like social media where it just is completely allowed to go on its own with no regulation. And so you have multiple executives saying regulate us, which was very interesting to see. And, you know, with Microsoft, they have had, I'm not going to say burned, I guess I am saying burned, they have had problems with the government before, right? They don't want to get into some big antitrust regulatory thing after the fact. I think when they're spending 13, 14 billion, some billions of dollars on this, they're like, tell us your concerns now so we don't get, so we don't cross you later in 10 years and have to have some big problem. I mean, they've had this antitrust stuff before. They even have something else going on with that now.
The other concern that we need to realize and come to grips with, perhaps, is that one, government has a very poor record of keeping up with technology. Social media is another good example of that. When I looked into this, I remember that Colin Powell, Secretary of State, came into office in the early 2000s and realized they needed to stop using Wang computers and maybe get computers that could do things like the internet, right? Mm-hmm. That's the level that we're dealing with. Fast forward to today, we have that slowness combined with the fact that AI is already here. I picked a few brains of some friends working in the tech industry locally, and they pretty much tell me that AI is basically building on top of something else that's already threatens jobs and so forth, which is automation. AI is like the next level above that. And they're saying it's already replaced a few jobs out there within their own tech sphere. Personally, I foresee this coming into the online content space, even the news media space, and perhaps replacing some functions and roles there. I don't think it's going to happen everywhere.
Next week, it'll just be three people on the show instead of four.
Exactly.
And we'll just see how that goes.
Well, and the thing is, I think there's some folks and customers clearly are not going to want an AI delivering their news. However, working in this industry long enough from many different angles, newspapers, TV, radio, someone is going to do it. Someone is going to have an AI gleaning a press release or information from Twitter or something, and then that AI is going to write a radio script, and that AI is going to work with another AI that's going to create a false voice and then go on air and do it.
Well, yeah.
Something's going to happen out there to do that.
We are having a conversation in our newsroom exactly about this, and one of the things that struck me is that exactly that. The simple functions can be automated.
Exactly.
You know, we think about sports box scores.
Yeah.
You know, simple write up a press release kind of thing. And you spit it through and it's interesting. Oftentimes it's wrong.
Yeah, that's the problem still. But maybe it won't be later. I don't know.
We're in the infancy right now. I already tried to get ChatGPT to write my own newsletter and
let me finish before my colleagues come for you with pitchforks. One of the things it will never be able to do is it'll not be able to develop sources. It won't be able to think critically about the a public record strategy or an investigative technique or whatever. The more sophisticated the functions of journalism are going to be more valuable, I think. They could be assisted by AI technology where if I'm going to be writing 15 public records requests a day for documents, it could automate that for me. You know, it could then remind me when I need to go check back for the records are back. But ChatGPT like a source. If you get information from it, you go get the original source. Like if the same way if somebody cites a report from, you know, some agency, you go get the report and make sure it's being said what is actually said. One of the things we're also thinking about is the business side, like how do we need to have some kind of crawler on our website to tell people none of this content was generated by AI? Because you can have an AI check for AI generated content. So I think in the news media industry, this is going to be a fascinating next few years.
I 100%
just keep an eye on the clock. I'm enjoying this. We have 2 minutes left. But go
on. I'll just say I 100% agree with you. It's just that business side that makes me have a little loss in faith around this entire issue. We live in an era of journalism where a lot of folks who kind of pull a lot of levers never came up through journalism and instead came with business degrees. And that is who is pulling the levers. And a lot of those decision makers, without offending too many people that I've worked with in the past, it's just they look at the landscape of the job and they think, what can we carve away and save money and carve away and save money? I'm worried we're not going to sell this ad this month and I need to carve away. And they're going to look at an AI and they're going to think, okay, we'll scale back the newsroom to do all the work that you just described, but we'll have the AI handle all this other stuff that we use people for. And that's the fear that I have for the future landscape of news media.
Yeah, that's really something to smile about. But
I know, don't.
But since we end the show, we got 1 minute. I will just give you something to smile about, which is watching paint dry, because the Space Needle is being repainted after a year of being Galaxy Gold for its anniversary, 60th anniversary. Anybody know the new color?
It's astronaut white.
Astronaut white, Melissa Santos. And also, the Seattle Times did this thing about the new Alaska Airlines 737 with the artwork. First time they've used artwork from an indigenous artist. Mm-hmm. It's the salmon theme. They have a salmon series that they're doing. And it's that, it's called, I didn't know what it was called, the Northwest Coast form line style, but you've seen that style. Alaska says that they're the first airline to have the name of the plane in an Alaska native language. And the Seattle Times put up the video of them, creating. It's busy, but I think busy in a good way. I think it's
pretty
fantastic.
And bright blue, and it's nice. Yeah,
it's
pretty
gorgeous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So paint dry. We got to go. Mm-hmm. You want to smile about the fact that you can leave now and have lunch with each other? All right, let's smile about that. And let me thank our producer of the show, Kevin Kniestedt, and also Juan Pablo Chiquiza and Tio Popescu and Bernard Ouellette running the board. And, of course, our panel, Axios, Seattle-based reporter Melissa Santos, Seattle Times investigations editor Jonathan Martin, KUOW online producer and editor Dyer Oxley. I'm Bill Radke. I hope you have a fantastic week. Thanks, everybody.
Good afternoon. Yeah.